This is the Good Things Guy podcast with myself, Brendan DeCute, South Africa's very own Good Things Guy. I'm on a mission to change what the world pays attention to. I truly believe that there's good news all around us, and I spend my time hunting down and reporting on the best good news stories from South Africa and the world. In the Good Things Guy podcast, you'll meet these everyday heroes and hear their incredible stories. In 2005, Sean Hyde was knocked down on the highway after experiencing trouble with his car. He was dragged for almost 900 meters and spent 3 months in hospital. He's led a relatively normal life since then and achieved so much with a body that simply does not work properly. Learning to walk on its own was a miracle. A few months ago, things started going horribly wrong. He started losing feeling in his legs, and although the feeling is not completely gone, the risk is too high for him to walk as his legs just give way with no warning, and so he has been confined to a wheelchair. Sean has joined us today to speak about the experience on the Good Things Guy Jackpot, and just to speak about what he's been through and this miracle that he's had and sort of what the future holds. And we always keep things positive, yeah? So it's not going to be heartbreaking and emotional. I hope not. But Sean, it's great to have you in studio. And I think what you've been through for all those years is just absolutely incredible.
It's been a journey. It's up and down. I won't say it's been a bed of roses. I've had a jaw for the last 14 years. A lot of people turn around and say, but how can you be so positive and how can you smile through everything that you've been through all the time? And you know what? I woke up this morning, I'm breathing. I've got a family, I've got kids, I've got a stunning wife. She's my pillar. So I've got the backing of people like my mother-in-law that drive me around. And we get up. We do what we need to do.
You know, tell me, in 2005, what exactly happened?
I had a blowout. I was driving in a little bucky, and I was coming down the N12, and I had a blowout on the one rear wheel, and I lost control of the van. I swerved across the highway, went up the embankment, came down, hit the barrier, went back across the highway, and the bucky eventually stopped under the, I don't know if you know the N12 at all. So if you come back from Boksburg, the highway that comes from the airport, that bridge part, that's where the bucky stopped. The cables that stopped the bucky there. I couldn't find my wallet. I couldn't find my phone or anything. Because the bucket had been all over, rattled all over the place. So I thought, okay, well, I'll take a walk up to Edenvale Road.
At that stage, you could still walk. Everything was...
I was still fine. I was still... I was a bit bruised and a bit shocked as I think anybody would feel from getting flung around. But I thought, okay, I'll take a walk up to... There's that BP garage at Sunny Ridge. I'd take a walk up there, give my father a call and say, listen, this is what's happened. Can you come and help me? And I took a walk, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Big mistake. Lesson: don't walk on the highway. At the end of the day, back then there wasn't emergency lanes. The emergency lane was maybe 25 centimeters wide from the yellow line to the grass.
The grass strip
in the center. And so I took a walk up, and as I got to the top of the hill, where you can see both sides of the highway, so you can see the west and the east bank, I looked. As I put my foot onto the yellow line, it caught me.
Did the car literally come out of nowhere?
I saw headlights. That's the last thing I remember was seeing headlights. The rest of what I'm going to tell you is done through investigation. So the investigating officer, so they got accident investigators that look at everything. They said that the blood trail and the skid marks, I was stuck under a car. So I was dragged for 900 meters or something. The car spat me out. My bottom half was in the fast lane. My top half was in the middle lane. And three cars drove over me. They say three cars, but it could be one car with three different set of tires. The clothes, the tire treads on the clothes, were three different treads that they had pulled off.
So after you'd rolled your car, you were walking on the highway. You then wanted to cross the highway. A car hit you, dragged you up to 900 meters.
Yeah.
You lay on the road, and then either one car or three cars still drove over you.
Correct. Over the bottom half of me. So luckily they didn't drive over the top of me. So they just kept driving over the bottom half. A gent by the name of Henny, he came down the middle lane. He nearly drove over my head. So he swerved out at the last minute because he realized that there's this human being laying in the road. He reverse parked his van or whatever he was driving. As far as I remember, he said he was driving a little van with his partner. And he parked in the middle of the, basically with me in the center. So no cars could hit me anymore with his hazards on. And he shouted at his partner, phone the ambulance. There was another car parked on the side of the highway with two young ladies in it that had phoned the ambulance already. And they were screaming at the ambulance service or emergency service that cars keep driving over this man. Please, can somebody get there?
I know you don't remember because of a trauma, but from what people have told you, were you still awake during this whole process?
When I spoke to Henny, he says I was in and out of consciousness. He says, because he ran up to me, he put his hand on my throat to feel if there was a pulse, if I was still alive, and I grabbed his hand. He stuck his two fingers down my throat to pull out the tar and sand and stuff, and I just started screaming for my dad. And then I'd pass out, and then I'd wake up, and I'd pass out. And I didn't, when I had spoken to Henny a couple of months after, he said that I wouldn't let his hand go until the paramedics got there. So I woke up in that time. I woke up and I looked up at the stars and I still said to myself, that's a beautiful sky, because I could see the stars. The highway is dark. And I put my hands down next to my body and I try to get up and it's like I can't move. And I looked down and I could see my left foot. I could see the underneath. I could see the bottom of my left foot on the side of my leg. And I was like, that's not good. And then I tried to get up and I looked down and I could see my intestines laying next to me. I know it sounds disgusting, it sounds terrible, but like I could just, and that's when I laid down and I thought, okay, I think I'm done. And that's the very last thing that I remember.
So I can only try, and the listeners as well, can only try to put themselves in that position, because it feels so overwhelming hearing the story. Mm. From that slight moment, if you go back to 2005, was it surreal when you – was it just – was it like being in a movie?
It was like I wasn't even in my body. It was like I was looking down. If I look back at it now, it was like I stand next to myself watching myself. Back there, I can't explain the pain. It's like my children ask me, but how sore was it? Especially my boys. It's like – every person is different. If you stomp your toe and I stomp my toe, the pain that you feel is different to the pain that I feel. I can't tell you how much pain it was. I can tell you that it was really sore, but I can't explain how sore it was. I'm sure it was sore.
Well, I'm totally assuming, because I don't have even a doctor's letter. You must have hit your head, so you were in and out of a consciousness because of that, but also from the pain.
Correct.
It literally knocks you out.
I had a huge gaping hole in the bottom of my back where the intestines, my spleen had burst, my bowel had burst, my spine had broken in two places. With the cars driving over me, my pelvis, hips were shattered. My right leg was broken in 24 places? 11 places?
It's I'm a little bit, I'm almost in shock, because it's a lot to take in to hear that someone someone's been through that and they've survived. And not only have they survived, but they're sitting across from you today. Like, it's just a lot for me to take in. How old were you at the time?
I was 25.
And you were working and you were sort of...
I just started a job. I'd been lucky to get a job. And I just started working. I'd been working as a truck driver for a tree company. So I was driving a truck for them at the time. And I'd only been with them for 2 weeks. So, and then this happened. But luckily, like I said, I had a lot of backing.
So I'm jumping back and forward, yeah, but I'm just trying to put the whole picture together. So Henny was there, and there were these two girls there, and they phoned the ambulance, and then the ambulance came.
So then the ambulance got there. The paramedics in the ambulance got there. They then brought the backboard out. They turned me onto my side to put the backboard down, and the paramedic looked at his partner and said, no. Went and got a bunch of sheets, folded the sheets to put in the hole, because the only thing keeping my top half and my bottom half together were my stomach muscles, because everything else was ripped. Everything. And when I mean everything. Okay. So they put sheets in, put me on a backboard. That's when they've called for the helicopter. At that stage, I still had a medical aid card. But because I wasn't working, I had stopped paying them. So I had defaulted on the medical aid. And they were just going under the...
Under the fact that you had the card.
I got a card, I must have medical aid. So they airlifted me from there. My heart stopped with a paramedic on the road, waiting for the helicopter. So they resuscitated me on the road. The helicopter got there. They resuscitated me in the helicopter on the way to the Union Hospital. I got to Union Hospital by 5 o'clock in the morning.
5 in the morning. So this happened at like 1
in the morning.
And a couple of hours later, four hours later, you eventually get to the hospital.
You eventually get to the hospital after paramedics have now resuscitated and pumped me full of medication and got me stabilized as much as I could on the road or in the helicopter. And the one nurse at the Union said, I don't care what number you give me. Just give me numbers. I need to get hold of someone. And the only number that actually worked was my sister's number, and she stayed down the road from the Union. She came up to the hospital. Her husband, herself, and my nephew, he was still an infant, they came up to the hospital. She gets to the hospital, and they won't let her come through the ER. They won't let her see me. So automatically, and they've pulled her into one of the rooms.
So she thinks the worst.
She thinks the worst, because now they're waiting for my father. They say, you need to get hold of your father. Your dad needs to come through. We're not going to let you see your brother until your dad gets here. Now, of course, the worst is going through the head. And eventually my dad gets there. And the doctor comes out to see them before they go into the back to see me. Doctor says, listen, this is the story. Sean, I don't know if he's going to make it. You're going to have to go and say goodbye. Simple. Sorry.
It's a lot of trauma. And I know that it happened so many years ago, but literally I'm listening to the story and I'm reliving it with you. And I can hear that it's incredibly tough what you and the family had to go through back then.
There's certain spots that open up. So the doctor said to my dad, say goodbye. He said, nope. No, that's not happening.
Not today.
Not today. I know my son. My son's a beast. And that's not him. He's not giving up. And they walked into the back. I was laying on my stomach because they couldn't put me on my back. I was laying on my stomach.
Were you conscious now, or is this retelling of the story?
This is my dad, and the stories that I've heard through nurses and doctors and family. And my dad said when he walked into the emergency room, I was laying on my stomach because they couldn't put me on my back because I had this gaping hole and all the damage. And my head was a size. He says it was bigger than a rugby ball, but it was the same shape as a rugby ball because it was bounced around so much. And he thought the worst as well, but he wouldn't give up. And my sister went berserk. And he walked up and he said, just calm down. He's still breathing. You can see on the monitor he's still breathing. He's got a heartbeat. He's fine. Just give him a kiss and tell him you'll see him later. They took me to theatre. I was in theatre for 9 hours. It was like almost the whole day I was in theatre. It was just trying to keep me alive. Because as much blood as they were pumping into me, that's as much blood there was just pouring out. Eventually I think it was 3 phenomenal doctors. It was Dr. Boutalis, Dr. Somwe. There was a whole bunch of doctors that saved me.
Well, I mean, if I hear and we look at in South Africa and specifically in Johannesburg, the Union Hospital is well known for trauma and for emergencies.
They are.
They're very well known.
They are. They are amazing. They are phenomenal. I was then put into ICU. I can't recall how many times I was back in theatre in that 7 days. I was back in theatre 2 or 3 times.
I could imagine that they had to do things almost like a project timeline to go, let's fix this now so we can save him. We can fix the broken leg later. Correct. Let's put the insides back in and make sure that they're... So there would have been some sort of process.
Correct. So they couldn't put any fixators or metal in my body because I had burst my bowel. So there was a lot of gunk, a lot of feces that had run through the body. So they cleaned everything out. My insides were in a bowl next to me under a sheet in the ICU. So when people came to visit me, the nurses or doctors would say, don't touch the bed. You can give him a kiss or rub his head, but do not touch the bed because his insides are in a bowl next to him. which was fine because you couldn't see anything because it was covered in a sheet. And my father says he's one recollection, and he didn't leave the hospital. He lost almost as much weight as I did because he wouldn't leave. The nurse eventually said to him, listen, you've got to go home. You're starting to smell. And he's like, okay, fine. And he went and got in his car. He slept in the parking lot, and he'd come back at the next visiting hours. He says to me that the one day there was this young girl that would come visit me or come see me. She came to see me the first time, and my heart rate went through the roof because that was one of my ex-girlfriends. And my heart rate went like skyrocket. And he walked in and he said to her, listen, you need to get out.
No, you need to get out.
You need to get out. And she turned around, she walked away, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, I'm here. And my heart rate just dropped and it just stabilized. And he said it was just weird that every time he walked in, I would just stabilize.
Wow.
Because I was in a medicated coma, because they medicate you for that kind of
thing. Yeah, so that you can heal.
Yeah, so you can heal. And he says it was just every time he came in, I would stabilize and I'd be fine. And it was 7 days, 6 or 7 days afterwards that they discovered now, not at the medical aid, because now they send in forms to the medical aid.
Oh, gosh.
And the medical aid go, they phone the medical aid and they say, Mr. Hyde is with us. We're not getting payment. And it's like, no, well, we can't pay you because he's faulted on payment on his side. And now we sit with them because now it's like 1.7, 1.8 million rand worth of medical.
And you're in a coma. So like, there's not much that you can do right now.
No, I can't do anything. I wasn't even eating in those 7 days, which I don't understand, but 1.8 million is worth a life, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they call him, James Bean, like a customer relations officer or something at the union. He arranged that I was transferred to the Folleteng in the Joburg General Hospital. So I was transferred to the Folleteng. There, a doctor by the name of Dr. Kite, Richard Kite, took over. He had come and seen me a couple of times in the union, and he had taken over. I was going into theatre twice a week for debridements just to clean out the wound because there was still a lot of gunk.
Were you conscious at this point?
No.
Still not?
When they first transferred me, I was still unconscious. I was still in a medicated coma. 2 days after I had gone into Folleteng, they reduced the medication, and Dr. Tilly, the specialist that runs the Folleteng section, he said, okay, let's wake him up. I remember waking up, and I looked at my sister. My sister was next to me, next to the bed, and that was just tears. She was just broken. And I looked at her, I was like, why are you crying? I don't understand. I really don't understand why are you crying?
I guess when you woke up, you're like, I'm awake. What's the problem?
I'm hundreds. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why I can't move, but I'm laying here. And at that time, myself, my wife, Julie, we went dating. We hardly knew each other. We grew up together, but we didn't know each other. We like passed each other. And my sister Jackie turned around and she said, do you recognize who this is? And I looked at her and I said, not really. I said, but she's got beautiful blue eyes, though. And she said, no, this is Julie, Glynis's daughter. Oh, okay. She says, but you haven't changed, even though you've been through everything. Yeah, a man's got to try what a man's got to try.
Did she come through to the hospital to see you?
Julie actually came through to the hospital to be with Jackie, to be with my sister, to be the strength for my sister. And we speak about it often. And she says when she didn't actually know me, she knew me as this party animal, as the loudmouth at get-togethers and that kind of thing. So we came from different backgrounds and upbringings and that kind of thing. And she basically came to the hospital just for Jackie. And then when she walked in and she saw me, as you know, she was like, no.
There's something there.
There's something there. There's something. Well,
doesn't the universe work in mysterious ways, right?
Proper.
It does. Proper. So we're getting a little bit off track. So you were in this hospital for 3 months.
Correct.
You were in the hospital for 3 months. In rehabilitation.
The first time I remember waking up was maybe 2 months into my hospital stay. That was in the May. I was transferred to the Folleteng. I would say the beginning of July, I actually realized...
2005.
That I actually realized I'm actually in hospital because I was so heavily medicated. I also got a virus. I picked up a virus in that time, MSRA. What it does is it eats all your healthy flesh.
Good
my body
grief.
My body would generate new skin and try and fix itself. And as quick as it was fixing itself, it was eating itself.
You went through this car accident, and then you got pulled by another car, and then you got driven over by another car, and then you got put in a hospital, and then you got moved to another hospital, and then as you're healing, it's like one thing after another. It's just not easy.
No. So Dr. Kite, he wouldn't give up either. They said that this MSRA virus got to a certain amount in the bloodstream, that's when they stopped antibiotics, because then there is no antibiotics in the world that's strong enough to fight this virus. And I got like, I think it was 3% below this maximum mark. And he said to my dad, I'm not giving up on your son. And they pumped me with this antibiotic that gave me, it was like, I had got a second layer of skin, but head to toe, where I was just red and my skin was peeling like I had been sunburned because of this antibiotic, but it worked with the Lautenbach irrigation system. So I can remember all these big words. It's really nice. So a Lautenbach irrigation system is a drain and a drip on the left side, a drain and a drip on the right side. You'd lay on your left side and it would drain. And then 2 hours later, or an hour
swap
later,
over.
Swap over to the other side. And they would do that for every hour, every 2 hours. I would lay on left side, right side, never on the back, never on the front. Eventually, they solved the virus. The virus had disappeared.
That's incredible.
It was like phenomenal. He was happy. Everybody was happy. I'm still sedated. I'm still as high as
a cart.
Proper. It's like, I'm so high that the TV that's in the ward goes around the bed. The one story I remember is they took me to the theater, but I was laying on a Chesterfield lounge, couch, sleeper thing. And they put me into theater, on a couch. And then the one day I was on a hammock, right?
He's not speaking to himself. His mother-in-law's in the studio with
him.
Just letting you know.
I'm not high now. not anymore. Unfortunately, they won't give me those drugs. They said that it's very addictive.
You know what? Actually, I'm laughing because your doctor, I'm sure it's Dr. Kite. He was in the video, right?
Yes.
So Dr. Kite said you are one of the funniest human beings he has ever come across. And he is in awe of how positive you have stayed and how incredibly positive you are, even though you've been through this crazy traumatic experience. And I can feel it in studio. You are literally making me laugh.
A lot of people still today, 14 years later, go, how can you be so happy? Your life has changed so much. You're in a wheelchair now. Aren't you upset that somebody drove over you and left you for dead? No.
You've just raised a really big question. Did they ever find the person?
They never found the person. Not one of the people that stopped. Not one of the people that drove over me had stopped. Not one of them. The two young ladies that stopped on the side of the highway, they came to see me once in the following thing. They never ever came back. They actually told me that they ate my KFC. I had KFC in my van that I stopped and bought. And I said, that's fine. You could eat my KFC. I said, there was nothing wrong with it, right? And she said, no. She says, but her thought was, well, he's not going to eat it, and it's going to go to waste. So she ate it.
I said, that's
perfectly fine.
That's crazy.
I said, that's as long as you're happy. Same as Henny. I got hold of Henny once or twice, and I understand where he's coming from. He said it's...
For him, it must have been traumatic.
He doesn't want to see me. And I understand it. And I get his point. And I understand it.
It's crazy that that someone literally rode over you and drove away and that they've never been caught. But I don't want to get into that. We're not here for that. This is for the good news.
Yes.
So 3 months afterwards, you leave hospital and you can walk.
No.
Not yet.
But I wake up and I've got a colostomy bag. I don't know. For any of the listener, if you don't know what a colostomy bag, your intestine or your bowel, it comes to your stomach and your feces go into this bag. And I've got a scar that runs from my breastplate all the way down about 4 centimeters above my groin area. I've got this long cut down the front where they went in from the front to fix everything. And I looked at my dad when I had woken up, because I'd been awake. I just wasn't awake.
Yeah, you weren't compos mentis.
Correct. And now I've realized, and my dad walks into the ward, and I pull the sheet back, and I say to him, Dad. He says, what's it, my boy? I said, what the hell is that? Why is my poo in a bag on the outside of my stomach? Because no one had explained to me, no one had told me what had happened to me. And that's when my dad and my sister and a psychologist came through, and they had told me what happened. Because to me, I got hit by a train. Mm. I thought I was driving the truck. and I had to go over a train track to a dump to dump.
It's crazy what the mind does to try and just to try and cope. Yeah. It's like a coping mechanism to help you through the trauma and to help you what you've been through so that you can get better and then get to a point where you can deal with the reality.
Correct.
So it is amazing what the mind does.
I used to argue with my dad as well, where I said somebody beat me and they tied me down that I couldn't move and they put me into one of the army trucks. But underneath this army truck, they put me into the truck from underneath, and I couldn't move, and I was screaming at them to let me go, and they wouldn't let me go, and you weren't there to help me. You weren't there to protect me. You're supposed to be my father. Only to realize a couple of months after that, that was the paramedics that had tied me down to the backboard, that I couldn't move my hands, and they were putting me into the helicopter.
Good grief.
So there was a lot of these things that I look back at, and I laugh at them.
You have to. You now are leaving hospital.
I'm leaving hospital. It was 2 days short of 3 months. The doctor said that I'm going to be there for 6 months minimum. Rehab for 12 months thereafter. I done it in 3. I was like, no.
Not today.
Not today, my friend. I need a steak or something. This jelly is it's no good. It's no good. You must understand, I went from 125 kg man to the day that, because they weigh you before you leave, I was under 50. I was like 42 or 43 kilograms when I left the hospital. I was like skin and bone. And so we put in the wheelchair and off we go. We go home, go to my late grand, because we were like that. If we were sick, I want my grand. I want to sit on my grand's lap. And at the age of 26, I still sat on her lap. He took me to my grand's house first before we went home. And he picked me up and he put me down on my grand's lap. And I gave her a hug and a kiss, and then I went home. I was fine. I saw my gran. I was good. We got home, and that's where life kind of changed. That's where I came to realize, because then you don't have the nurses. You don't have 24-hour help around, and life has to go on. And I get that. I understand that people can't be around you all the time, and people have their lives to do. They got work. They got to look after their families and that kind of thing.
But also you say it in the broad stroke of sort of the sentiment is that life has changed. But really, I get that life has changed for the people around you. But for you, your entire way of living has changed.
Correct.
Because all of a sudden, you're not able to drive. You need to learn how to get from your chair to the bed. Your house might not be...
They actually moved. We stayed in a block of flats in Alberton North. It had 9 units in it, so it wasn't this huge block of flats. But we stayed on the second floor.
There's no way to get there.
There was no way to get there. And my father had arranged with the owner of the flats that one of the flats on the ground floor had gone empty in that time that I was in the hospital, and he had spoken to the landlord or the owner, and they had moved downstairs. So it was easier for me to get access in and out, even though I wasn't going to be going anywhere. And then I was a lot of things still like now. It's back again where I can't tie my shoes. Those little things that you take for granted.
So, I mean, this is why we have you in studio today, is because we're skipping along a little bit. But your body did get better.
It did get better.
And
yes.
You went into rehabilitation and no rehab.
No rehab. I didn't have medical aid. I didn't have the funds.
Do they not have government rehabilitation?
No. No government.
What?
They don't have government rehab.
That, for me, is absolutely shocking.
We will get to the government side, which is, and I can understand where they're coming from with the government side. But I'll get into that with you now as well.
How did you then get to a place where you were walking?
Frustration. I got to a point where I was in a wheelchair on my own.
Sean, you're telling me
yes.
that your spine was broken.
In 2 places.
Your spine was broken in 2 places.
Yes.
You had to get multiple operations to put your body back together.
Yes.
And you're telling me that you started walking again out of frustration.
Yes.
That is a miracle.
Yes. Doctor turned around and said to my dad that I would never walk again. He said, we're not going to do a hip replacement, because they wanted to do a hip replacement back in 2005. And the doctor turned around and said, Sean's never going to walk again.
So what's the point?
So what's the point of spending money on a hip replacement, where we can take that money that you're going to use and use it for anesthetists or the debridements or something else to get him stable. And my father said, that's perfect.
Take me back to this day. Did it happen gradually, or was it literally just a...
Gradually. I was on my own quite a bit when I got home. There were people in and out, come visit me, and like they say in Afrikaans, neskierigheid.
Mischievous.
Correct. So the people who come in just to see the man that got hit by three cars and he survived, kind of a thing. But that also died down. So I'm in the wheelchair. I got out of bed, and I got into the wheelchair, and I wheeled myself through the flat. I put the kettle on to make myself some coffee. Now it's a bit higher for my arms. And I picked the kettle up, and I started pouring my mug of coffee. Because of the counter height, you can't see. So, of course, I've overfilled the cup, and it's hot water and coffee all over the counter now. Now I've got to clean this counter. Now I'm frustrated, and I'm starting to get depressed.
You know what? What you're saying is we take for granted. Because if I spill a cup of coffee, get a cloth and wipe it. But for you, if I can give the listeners an idea, think of if you're looking at a counter and it's at eye level.
Correct.
You can't. Everything's 100 times harder.
Correct. At that point, I was like, I can't do this. I cannot do this at eye level anymore. I feel like this little child that's waiting for my daddy to come home from work to make me a meal, to make me coffee, or somebody to come visit me so they can make us coffee. And I put my hands on the counter, and I stood up. And I held myself on the counter with one hand, and I made my coffee with the other hand, and I sat down, and I drank my coffee, and I thought, well, there we go.
If I can do that, I can, my gosh.
I did stand once in the hospital because the physiotherapist did come to the hospital. Now I'm jumping back to the hospital again. The physiotherapist came through and Dr. Kite said we must mobilize him. So I'd been laying flat for 2.5 months and she set me up the first day and I was sitting up for maybe 30 seconds and I was like, no, boink. And I fell over. And she came back the next day and we sat up again. And then she said, we're going to try and stand today. It was like a week later. And I said, we're going to do this. Yes, we're going to do this. And she was quite short, but she was stocky. Quite a hottie, actually. Athletic body. Like most physiotherapists.
He says with his mother-in-law sitting next to him.
It's fine. She knows. She met her. Listen. I proposed to my mother-in-law before my wife.
Oh, I love this.
Come on.
Craziest interview I've ever done.
If you brought me chocolates or food, or you used to bring me milk and chocolates, right? Every Friday, I'd get a slab of chocolate and
Sean, we're jumping around.
So she picks me up.
Yes.
So she picks me up. And so I'm sitting on the bed. She stands in front of me. She puts her hands under my arms and she says 1, 2, 3, and we stand. And the amount of pain that I felt like I was hit by a train that just went through the lower part of my back. And all of a sudden, I'm standing behind myself. I'm behind myself. I'm holding myself up at the back of my head, looking at her face, holding myself up. And it felt like I had been standing for 10 minutes. Meantime, she only let me stand for maybe a minute and put me down again. That was about it. As far as the walking part went, I did.
But even though that had happened in hospital, the doctor's prognosis was still that you would never walk.
I would never
walk. So he'd seen the reports on that and the fact that you couldn't really stand and you'd felt the pain and he'd known what section of your spine you'd broken.
Correct.
So they'd sort of had this diagnosis that you would never walk.
Correct.
Again.
That was orthopedic specialist's opinion. But it's the same as Dr. Dominique saw me. He came and saw me once and he said, I regret to tell you that you'll never have children again. He said everything was ripped off.
And you didn't have kids at that
stage? No, I did. I had two beautiful children, Sebastian and Savannah, with my previous wife. He said that it was ripped off. It was off. It was being held on by maybe one nerve and a little bit of skin. And he said, I'd done my best. He says, to my knowledge and to my practice and to all my studies, he says, I put everything back as good as I could. And I said, as long as you've done something, Doc. And he said, if it does work, you'll never have kids again because your tubes and everything were severed. But again, I'm going to tell you, I put everything back as good as my knowledge allows me to, as my hands allow me to. And I said, that's perfect. Julie doesn't like me telling the story. She says, you can't tell that story.
It's his wife, for everybody
my wife.
To know.
At the time, she wasn't my wife. She wasn't even my girlfriend at the time. And he left that afternoon, and she came to visit me. And now you must understand, I had a fixator, an external fixator through the pelvis at that point. And I said to her, after a lot of talking backwards and forwards, I said to her, just for medical science.
My God, I know where this is going.
You know where it's going, right? See, even my mother-in-law puts her head down because she knows the story.
Sean, this is a PG show. This is a PG show.
So she done it anyway. She done it anyway. Okay. And truth, Bob.
It worked.
I hit the button. I hit the alarm. I hit that siren. I almost pushed my thumb through that siren that you get to call a nurse.
That's so funny.
And it stopped. We didn't finish anything. I just wanted to see if it worked. That's all. I didn't want to see.
And it worked.
It worked. I didn't do anything after that. The nurse came running in. The nurse said, what is wrong? I said, I want to go home.
His mother-in-law didn't want to be on air today, but she's sitting here and she has her hands wrapped over her head. She can't actually look at me or Sean. This is the most ridiculous interview I've ever had. Ridiculous.
And I was perfectly happy. It works.
We're all thankful that it worked. And you have had kids since then.
Yes.
So it really works.
It really does work.
That's amazing.
I saw Dr. Somewhere a few years later, and I said he owes me some money. And he said, why? I said, because you said I will not have children again. So therefore, I did not use protection because I cannot have kids. And I've got a beautiful set of twins.
Twins. That's amazing. Okay, but I've got two big things to ask. One, yes. Medical aid. So the first bill was worth whatever the amount is. Did you have to pay that off? What happened?
We claimed through RAF, Road Accident Fund claim. That was all settled. How the RAF worked at that time, I know that it's changed since then. They worked on merits. So I won the case with a 40% merit, 60% to blame. So I was 60% to blame. The reason for that was
I was walking on the highway. Got you.
Dark, that kind of thing, which I accepted, which it's perfectly fine. It makes sense. It's logical. There again, we requested, because the file is now in Pretoria. My file is in Pretoria, and that's a bit of a distance for me to travel. And I can't travel that far at the moment. It hurts too much to get it transferred to Joburg, because on that there's a certificate, so I can claim for anything like now for the hip replacement.
This is why you're in the studio today. So you went through this process, and I'm speeding up the story a little bit, but you went through this process where you were so frustrated that you put yourself in a position where you could learn and teach yourself how to walk again. You managed to do that. You managed to create an amazing life for yourself for the past 14 years. And a couple of months ago, something went wrong.
I was sort of working as a coffee technician on their coffee side, Aquespresso side, carrying heavy coffee machines, like 30, 35 kg coffee machines.
Again, take a step back. If you're listening, he couldn't walk, and now he's carrying massive things.
And up and downstairs with water bottles and coffee machines and that kind of thing. I would get sore once, twice a month. I'd get sore, but I'd write it off because now my mindset, I'm walking, I'm relatively... It's been 14 years, and I'm healthy. I hardly get sick. I hardly get the flu even. So I kept going to the clinic because I still don't have medical aid. Because medical aid, R3,500 a month. And then they exclude everything. They exclude my hips, my back, my pelvis, everything that I actually need. So what's the point of me paying R3,500 when I can go to a state hospital, state clinic, and whatever the case is. So I was going to the state clinic in Bedford View. I was there so often. The nurse eventually knew my name. She said, Sean, come through to my consulting room. Let's have a look. And she opened my file and she said, listen, you've been here too often. I can't give you anything more for pain. I need to refer you. I said, that's fine. And I went through to the Joburg. They said they don't do x-rays anymore on outpatients. You got to go to Hillbrow for x-rays.
Move again.
From there, I went to Edenvale Hospital, because Edenvale does everything. Again, through the whole triage thing. And at that point, I still believed that it was muscle.
Yeah, you're like, I've pulled something
in my back or whatever. And I'm walking. I'm standing. I'm standing in this queue, and all of a sudden my legs go dead and I just fall over. People around me are picking me up and holding me, and humanity really shows at that point where people are really helping of you, and people make space on a bench for you to sit and that kind of thing. So I saw the doctor take the x-rays back.
Did you tell him about your accident 14 years ago?
Yes, and he got very upset because...
You just walk in blind and go, I've got a sore back.
I went in and I told him, I said, listen, I've got a cramp in the right hand side of my back. And
he was like, oh, well, what did you do? Well, I was in a very bad car accident 14 years ago.
And he said, but why didn't you go to the Joburg Gym? And I said, I did. And they referred me, yeah. And he was really upset. He said, I should have went. They should have taken me at the Joburg because my file and everything is there with them. I said, well, this is where I am now. And he looked, he picked up the x-rays and looked at the x-rays and he said, you've really stuffed it up. Your right hip, pelvis and lower spine are all fused together. I said, okay, well, what do we do? He says, you have to go through the orthopedic section. I said, okay, let's get this done. Go make a booking. They gave me a booking for June. That was in April. I was like, okay.
You're in pain.
I'm in
You're
pain.
You're now falling over.
I got to wait until June to actually see somebody that specializes in bones. That's fine. I go home. Julie then gets hold of Dr. Richard Cart because he's my doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't work in state anymore. He only does private practice now. He says, no, I must go to the spinal clinic at the Joburg Gym. Perfect. After 30 phone calls, Julie eventually gets to speak to someone that can help her. Gives her an appointment for the 28th of January 2020.
Sorry, what?
28th of January 2020 is the first time they can see me. That is not to do anything else.
Just
except
a consultation.
For a consultation. They said if anything else proceeds, the next appointment would then be August of 2020. Then my company, they've been very helpful. They paid for me to see Dr. Khan privately and for x-rays to be done or whatever the case is, so we could get the ball rolling. Dr. Khan then sent me for x-rays. And he said the same thing. Do you want to touch my spine? He's not going to look at my spine. He said, we have to do the hip replacement first, and then we can look at the spine. He says,
So you have no idea what the future holds and what operations need to happen.
No.
You know that there's a problem.
Yes.
You know that you're now today back in a wheelchair.
I knew that I was going to end up in a wheelchair. I just didn't know it was going to be this soon.
But now you need the operation. And that's why we have you in studio today, is because the way that I came across your story is your daughter started a fundraiser for you.
Correct.
How old is she?
17.
17. And what did she do?
She raffled one of her drawings.
She's an artist?
She's an artist at JP Girls. She is a phenomenal artist. And she said, well, I want to do a picture for my dad that we can raffle off. And we've done that and we raised 10,000 rand within a week.
That's amazing.
And that's how we've been going, is trying to raise these funds.
What is the amount that we need to get to?
So
we don't know exactly, right? You need a hip replacement now.
A hip replacement now.
But we don't know what the
future holds.
Yes.
There is spinal damage, but we don't know what the extent of spinal damage there is. So we could do the hip replacement and not be able to do anything on the spine and I end up in the wheelchair anyway. So it's all like a bit of a gamble. The hip replacement, if I do it privately, so if I do
it... Which you're opting for because you don't want to wait until...
Correct.
August 2020.
If I do it privately, anything between 250 and 300,000 rand. If I do it through the Folleting with Dr. Khan, between 200 and 250,000 rand, which is 50,000 rand less than the private. But I don't have 250,000 rand. Even if I do get a certificate from the RAF, they're only going to pay 40% of that, which still leaves about 180,000 rand that I would have to find somewhere. And I said to him, okay, so what if we do it through the state? And Dr. Khan said, that's fine. He says, a minimum of 5 years waiting.
5 years?
5 years. 5 years waiting before I would have a hip replacement. And that's if I fit the criteria. Because what they do is they take the patients, they take like 5,000 hip replacements. And they say, okay, who's the candidate? And right now, with my spinal damage, not knowing how much damage is on the spine, they will rather give that hip to somebody that they can do a hip replacement, and they know for certain that person is going to get up and walk and live a normal life, instead of giving it to someone that they're going to do a hip replacement, and they're not going to be able to use the hip anyway in the next 4 months or 5 months.
Sure.
Again, it leaves a bit of a bitter taste or bitterness in the mouth. Where if you've got the money and you put the money down on the table, we'll do whatever you want us to do because we've got the money. But if you don't, then I'm sorry for you.
But you're not completely left hopeless because there is hope within you.
There is,
and your support structure are all there helping you.
Yes.
I mean, your beautiful mother-in-law drove you here today and got to listen to stories that made her cry. And then stories that made her really cry.
Yes.
And your daughters and your friends and people are trying to raise this amount for you so that you can get this operation done sooner. What is the plan then? How are we going to raise these funds?
Any way we can to get the story out there, any way that we can get to that point. of having the hip replaced so that we know where we can go from there.
Yeah.
Once that is done, then we can have the MRI done and we can see, okay, this is the extent of damage on the spine. Yes, we can do something. No, we can't do something. There's a whole lot of factors. My nerves were severed in the first accident, so I don't have all my nerves. I haven't stood and urinated since 2005. I sit down. I go to the toilet and I sit down. And now my legs go dead. I stand, I lose balance, and I fall over. My legs are just dead. I don't have feeling in my legs anyway, as from 2005, I've never had feeling in my legs. But now they go dead to a point where I fall over. My arms go dead. The last 2 weeks or so, my fingers are like almost permanently tingling, like a pins and needles sensation. That's got to do with nerves in your lumbar area. And the doctor says, once the hip is replaced, once that
there's a line and everything's good.
Yeah, everything's lined up. Then those nerves, because what he suspects is one of those nerves are pinching on that calcified bone, and that's what's causing that.
Well, we are all about the good news, and this is called the Good Things Guy Jackpot. And our listeners and our readers, they generally do have big hearts, and when they hear stories that mean something to them, they tend to come up with really creative ways to raise money and to assist. So we're hoping that after today's show that we're able to give you an update. And I'm not talking about you, Sean. I'm talking about our listeners. We'll give them an update as to maybe some good things that have come from this. I want to thank you so much for sharing your story. I want to thank you for stopping to share some stories. I'm kidding. But it's been great having you on the show. And you are really just a ray of light.
Like, thank you. Thank you.
What you've been through is absolutely traumatic, but you have this great aura about you.
You're
incredibly positive. And I want to thank you for just keeping on.
I want to thank you for doing what you do.
No. This show is not about me.
Listen. A little bit of ego doesn't hurt anyone.
It has been so great having you on the show. Guys, thanks for tuning in and thanks for subscribing and doing all the things that you're supposed to do. My listeners are the only reason why this podcast exists. We are doing great things here at Jackpod. And I just want to thank my listeners for continuing to tap in and pick up on the good things.
Go look at the new site.
Go look at the new website. There we go.
The new website. Yeah.
Thank you, Sean.
No problem.
Thank you. And only good things.
I'm Brent Lindekue, South Africa's very own Good Things Guy, and you've been listening to Good Things Guy, a Jackpod podcast. For more episodes or to subscribe, rate, or review my podcast, go to iTunes, Iona FM, or Google Podcasts. Be kinder than necessary to yourself and each other. Thanks, and only good things.